This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, we've got an announcement. We're going to be soon releasing a new series. We're calling it Chinese Prestige, and it's a history of modern China with the great Yidi Wu. Similar to our Of This World series, this History of China series will be available for free to annual subscribers. So if you are not an annual subscriber, please consider signing up to that tier. Everyone else, it's going to cost the usual $5. We think you'll really like it. We have gotten a lot of requests over the years to do something deep on China, a really deep dive into how it became the country, the nation state that it is today. And Derek, I don't know if what you think. I think this is really one of our best series. I think it's really fascinating. It gives an entire overview of China from with a great scholar. Again, that's Yidi Wu, who's just excellent at what she does. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but everyone keep your eye out for that. Anything you want to add, Big D?
It's very good. People should check it out. Yeah. Yidi is excellent, and it was a very long and deep look at. I mean, it's what, 10 episodes? So it's definitely,
it is a lot of episodes. I forget how many episodes. It's 8, 9, or 10, but we've spent a lot of time on it.
Somewhere along that.
And we really do think you'll like it. So check it out. And again, to get it not for quote unquote free, but to get it for a good deal, become an annual subscriber. All right, Derek, let's jump in the news. And let's start with Mohammed bin Salman's leader of Saudi Arabia, his visit to the White House.
Well, he's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Let's be clear. He's not the
official
no,
leader.
He's the de facto leader. But I only say that because it was a somewhat absurd visit on Tuesday, because it was a state visit in every detail. He had a meeting with Trump. They had a big ceremony on the White House lawn, and Trump greeted him. And, then they had a dinner in the evening. Like, it was all the trappings of a state visit, but they couldn't call it a state visit because he's technically not the leader of Saudi Arabia. Like, his father, his senescent father, is still nominally king of that country. So they had to call it a working visit, even though in every respect it was a state visit. So yes, MBS turned up. It was a real milestone for people who have ever ordered the murder and dismemberment and probably dissolution and acid of a political rival or foil of some kind, to be invited to the White House to just let bygones be bygones, basically, because that's what we did. In terms of substance, I've seen two major things come out of this, one of which is real and one of which is probably a little fictitious. The real one is the major defense sales package, as the White House put it, that they agreed to, that was already pretty much in place before MBS showed up. This is the deal under which the U.S. will be selling the Saudis F-35s, in theory. Now, you know, there's a lot of steps that have to go. They have to go through to get to the point where the Saudis actually are obtaining and using F-35s. And the sale could break down. There was, when the UAE joined the Abraham Accords several years ago, they also made a deal to buy the F-35. And then, about a year later, a little over a year later, backed out of that deal because of all the conditions that the U.S. was setting on the use and sort of just the operation and the terms of the sale. The UAE was not happy with that, so they just backed out of it entirely. That could happen here as well. There's been a lot of discussion about, you know, selling the Saudis F-35s, and is that going to eat into Israel's qualitative military edge, the thing that by U.S. law, the United States is required to maintain on behalf of the state of Israel in any arms deals in the Middle East. It is not, apparently, we've been assured that whatever planes the Saudis purchase, the F-35s they buy will be less advanced than the F-35s that Israel flies. So good news for anybody who worries about Israel's qualitative military edge. The second thing that came out of this was MBS, and they had a big business forum. This was a two-day visit. The second day was devoted partly to this business forum. MBS promised to invest $1 trillion in the United States. This is up from $600 billion that he committed to invest in the U.S. when Trump visited Saudi Arabia earlier this year. This is probably fictitious. It's just a nice big number to impress Trump and get headlines. Whether we actually see anything like that happen, it very much remains to be seen. The other items on the agenda were Saudi Arabia potentially joining the Abraham Accords, normalizing relations with Israel. MBS reiterated his position that he will not normalize relations with Israel absent what he calls a clear path to Palestinian statehood. As we've said before, this is a massive concession to Israel. The Arab position used to be statehood. There has to be a Palestinian state before we will normalize relations with Israel. Now it's this meaningless clear path to statehood language. But the Israelis still won't take the W, basically, because even nodding vaguely in the direction of Palestinian self-determination is too far for Israeli politics at this point. So that seems to still be kind of stalled out. There was at one point an intrepid reporter who dared to ask a question about the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's Turkish consulate, Istanbul consulate, back in 2018. That reporter was treated to a real dressing down from Trump, who at various points claimed that Mohammed bin Salman knew nothing about the murder, which contradicts multiple investigations, including the conclusions of Trump's own intelligence agencies. He sort of insinuated that Khashoggi, who he called extremely controversial and said that a lot of people didn't like him, sort of insinuated that he had it coming at one point. Really a classy White House moment for the president. MBS handled the question, I would have to say, more diplomatically. He called the murder painful and a huge mistake and said he's trying to make sure that it doesn't happen again. So that was the main substance. The one other thing that may be worth mentioning here is that Mohammed bin Salman came to the White House, and this was reported before he arrived, planning to appeal to Donald Trump to do something about the conflict in Sudan. And so Trump literally said after he met with MBS that he's going to do something about Sudan. He actually said he's going to do something very powerful having to do with Sudan. So that is inspiring stuff. I don't know, obviously, what that might look like. There is a concern here that if this is on Trump's radar, and you might ask, you know, why is the world's greatest peacekeeper not already doing something about Sudan? He said in the second day at the business forum that it was not on his charts to be involved in because he thought it was just something that was crazy and out of control. That's a direct quote. But now that he sees how important it is to MBS, he's going to do something about it. There is a concern here that doing something could mean throwing U.S. support behind the genocidal Rapid Support Forces militant group because it is nominally secular, whereas the Sudanese military, the other player in this conflict, is sort of allied to some degree, working with the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, Trump might have a natural affinity toward the RSF, but the Saudis actually have more of an affinity toward the Sudanese military at this point. So if MBS is kind of steering Trump in a direction here, it'll probably be away from at least abjectly supporting the RSF and maybe toward a more middle path. We'll see if he's prepared to do anything. If he is, if he's prepared to put pressure on the UAE to stop backing the RSF, if he's prepared to put pressure, on the Egyptian government to stop backing the Sudanese military, maybe something could come of that, but we'll see.
Thanks, Derek. Let's turn to this new Ukraine peace deal that the United States is pushing.
Yes. So this is reported in Axios on Tuesday that the Trump administration has put together a 28-point plan for ending the war in Ukraine. It's being spearheaded by Trump envoy Steve Witkoff, who is famous for going to Moscow, meeting with Vladimir Putin and just absorbing like a sponge anything that Putin says about the war, about Ukraine, or about Ukrainian and Russian history. He's done it in collaboration to some degree with Russian envoy Kirill Dmitriev. So you can imagine this was already, you know, when Axios broke the story on Tuesday, they didn't have any details about the plan, but you could already imagine it was going to be heavily lopsided in favor of Russia. And it turns out that it is. Axios and the Financial Times both reported on it the following day. The details, what is being described in these reports is basically a Ukrainian capitulation. It's you know, the same general terms that Trump and Vladimir Putin negotiated or discussed in the big Alaska summit back in August or around that time, when you know Trump was really prepared to you know force a surrender on Ukraine, and they wound up you know kind of pulling back from that. The territorial component, as it was back then, is Ukraine would be obliged to cede the remainder of the Donbas, that's Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, to Russia. Ukraine still holds about 15%, 14 to 15% of that region. So they would just be giving this territory up to Russia in the settlement. The other front lines, the front lines in the other two provinces in question here, mainland provinces, Kherson and Zaporizhia, would be frozen where they are. Which also was more or less what the two leaders had discussed earlier this year. There is one minor change in that 15% of the Donbas that Ukraine would be surrendering to Russia. From what I read, and I believe it was in Axios, that this territory would be classified basically as demilitarized, so the Russian military would not be able to put assets there. That may be a bit of a change, small one. There would be an expectation that the U.S. and other countries would recognize the Crimea and Donbas as legally Russian territory, but the Ukrainian government would be spared that particular humiliation. It would be required to accept severe restrictions on the size and capability of its military. So it would have to cut its military roughly 50%, I think, was the figure. And forswear any long-range weapons of the sorts that they've been using to strike targets inside Russia. Volodymyr Zelensky already appears to have rejected this. I mean, it's been circulated. It's been advanced enough that it's been circulated to the Ukrainians, to European leaders. The Europeans gave it the cold shoulder after these reports came out. Zelensky, I don't think, has commented publicly, but he was supposed to have a meeting with Witkoff in Turkey this week and canceled it, which is probably an indication that he was not happy with where things were. So that's basically where it stands.
Let's move on to Israel-Palestine. And I guess the biggest news of the week is, of course, the IDF is still killing people. So what's been going on there, Derek?
Yes. I mean, this goes without saying at this point. I mean, they kill a few people seemingly in Gaza every day. But on Wednesday and overnight into Thursday, the IDF carried out one of its bigger barrages since the ceasefire came into effect, killing at least 30 people at this point. It was 28 at the kind of close of business on Wednesday, and then overnight killed at least it was 25 to 28. And then overnight they killed, I think, five people. So it's 30, maybe 32, 33 or more at this point. I don't have a specific figure, but it's unclear. There was some kind of incident, according to the Israelis, in Khan Yunis, where their soldiers came under attack and they retaliated by carrying out airstrikes. There were also strikes on a couple of Gaza City suburbs in the northern part of the territory. Those were allegedly connected to Hamas somehow. Most of the casualties seem to have been women and children. You can question to what degree they were connected with Hamas. But another uptick, I guess, in the violence is worth noting.
Could you also tell us about these shelters that are failing in heavy rain?
Yeah, I mean, it's the tents, the, you know, relatively unsophisticated tents that people have been sheltering in. Almost the entire population of Gaza has, of course, lost its home, lost their homes, been displaced. They've been making do with these very minimalist tents, which have been inadequate, were inadequate even, you know, during the summer months. But now that we're heading into winter, they are wholly inadequate to the environmental conditions. There was heavy rainfall late last week in Gaza that left a number of these tents flooded, families flooded out of the only shelter they have. Aid agencies have stockpiled more durable shelter materials outside of Gaza to bring in for the winter to accommodate people. They are being prevented from doing so by the Israelis, who still are not allowing aid into the territory at the level stipulated under the ceasefire agreement. And the shelter materials have been, I think, probably the worst, the most affected by those limitations, because there's just very little to nothing getting in. So people are stuck in these really inadequate tents as they're facing worsening weather conditions.
Thanks, Derek. And what about this UN vote on the Trump plan for Israel-Palestine?
The Security Council voted on Monday to approve the Trump ceasefire framework, basically to authorize the stabilization force, this international force that's supposed to go into Gaza that still doesn't have any commitments from anybody to participate in. It also authorizes the so-called Board of Peace, which is to be chaired by Trump. It will include, regional expert Jared Kushner. It will definitely include Tony Blair, which is a welcome thought to anybody in the Middle East, I would think, at this point. So it authorizes these things. It authorizes basically setting up Gaza as a League of Nations mandate for the 21st century. There was a pushback in the Security Council from Russia, which introduced another resolution that was, I think, weighted a little bit more in favor of a Palestinian role in governing Gaza. But the Russians withdrew that after the Palestinian Authority, which is the organization that would be expected to take up that role, threw its support behind the U.S. Resolution. So there was really no leg left for Russia to stand on. Russia and China abstained rather than vetoing. Hamas and other factions in Gaza have already rejected the resolution. Their argument is that it simply codifies continued occupation, makes it a little more of an international occupation than an Israeli occupation, but doesn't really change materially anything for the Palestinians. I would imagine that Hamas signaling its rejection only encouraged council members to vote in favor. So I don't think that would have swayed anybody in any direction. This is important in that there were some countries that have been talking about maybe we'll participate in the stabilization force, maybe we'll contribute to the Board of Peace or contribute financially to reconstruction, but we need it to be done under some UN aegis, or at least with UN approval. We'll see if that actually holds up. I mean, when the rubber hits the road, there's still a lot of, questions about what this force is supposed to do, about what the Board of Peace is supposed to do, how it's supposed to operate, at what level is there actually going to be any Palestinian involvement. There's talk of a committee of technocrats, put all those things in quotes if you want, that would run the day-to-day management of Gaza during whatever reconstruction goes on. It's all still very nebulous, and I think it's going to be a lot for other countries to try and participate without more clarity.
Let's talk about this strange flight from South Africa and what that might indicate.
This happened over the weekend. The South African government announced that it was investigating the circumstances of a flight that arrived in Johannesburg at the international airport there on Thursday of last week, carrying 153 Palestinians from Gaza who didn't have proper travel documentation, and this is sort of spun out over the ensuing days. The media outlets, including Al Jazeera, have uncovered a group called Al Majd Europe, which is run by an Israeli-Estonian national who has been charging people in Gaza thousands of dollars. The people who were on this flight said $2,000 a seat, basically to be bussed out of Gaza to Ramon Airport in Eilat, the city in southern Israel, and then flown from there to parts unknown, you know, various countries around the world. This was the second flight that had arrived, apparently, in South Africa. It's unclear why this one triggered the authorities where the first one didn't. But, you know, the concern here, I think, is that this is part of the ethnic cleansing plan, right? I mean, the Israeli government earlier this year relaxed restrictions on people leaving Gaza if they were planning to, you know, head to an airport and fly away. And Israeli leaders have talked repeatedly about voluntarily getting, you know, voluntarily ethnically cleansing, basically, if that's a thing, Gaza, like encouraging people to leave, but of their own accord, obviously. So this scheme seems like a way to do that piecemeal at a low enough level that you would hope, if you were running it, wouldn't attract too much attention. In this case, it has. So we'll see how that spins out. This is also happening at a time when the U.S. is talking about long-term partitions in Gaza. There's talk of, you know, we've talked about this before, but there's talk of dividing Gaza into what the U.S. is calling red and green zones. The green zone would be where the reconstruction happens. It would be the territory that's currently controlled by the Israeli military. And eventually people in the red zone, if they've been screened and checked out, would be invited to relocate to the green zone. And the red zone would be left a wasteland, essentially, with Hamas kind of ruling a pile of rubble, is, I think, the way that this is envisioned. It's also happening at a time when the Israelis are moving, apparently, our friends at DropSite have video of this, moving the so-called yellow line that marks the territory that the IDF is controlling, pushing into Gaza City. They did this on Thursday morning, apparently. They sent tanks into an eastern part of Gaza City and physically moved the big yellow stones that mark the outline of this, mark the borders of Israeli-controlled territory, physically pushed them deeper into the city. So, you know, that's happening too, all of a piece, I think, with the idea that people are being pushed into smaller and smaller pockets of land and eventually off the land is where this is heading.
Really, really grim stuff as usual. Speaking of more grim stuff, let's do a Greater Israel update. Let's talk about Lebanon and Syria.
Yeah, Lebanon has been, like Gaza, continually bombed. This has been going on for over a year at this point, since the nominal ceasefire late last year between Israel and Hezbollah. The Israeli military has continued to attack Lebanon, you know, on a daily basis, if not more frequently than that, really. Earlier this week on Tuesday, it killed at least 13 people in the Ain al-Hilwa refugee camp in southern Lebanon. It's a Palestinian refugee camp. It killed another, at least one person over the weekend in a drone strike. And then there was the Wednesday, I believe, strikes that the Israelis carried out, where they issued evacuation orders for four southern Lebanese villages, so indicating a level of intensity and planning that is not typically the case for these attacks. That those strikes killed at least one person as well. They claim to be targeting Hezbollah infrastructure that's banned under the November ceasefire deal. You know, regularly bombing Lebanon is also banned under that deal, but that doesn't seem to matter to the Israelis. There was also a report, and this is where the Greater Israel piece comes in, I think, somewhat tongue-in-cheek or you know, kind of dark humor, I guess. But the UN peacekeeping mission in Lebanon, whose forces came under Israeli fire over the weekend, by the way, there were no casualties, but did come under attack, has been claiming that they've seen a security wall that the Israelis are building partially along the northern border, partially along the blue line, which is the UN-designated line that acts as de facto border between Israel and Lebanon. But according to the peacekeepers, the peacekeeping mission UNIFIL, This border wall actually crosses the blue line and enters Lebanese territory and basically cordons off parts of southern Lebanon. I think they said 4,000 square meters of Lebanese territory in the UN statement, cordoned off from the rest of Lebanon, basically, by this construct. So, yeah, another indication of potentially long-term intention to stay at least in a small segment of Lebanese territory on that side of the border. In Syria, of course, the Israelis have been occupying territory in southern Syria since the downfall of Bashar al-Assad's government back in December. And if you consider the Golan, then since 1967, but just considering the stuff that they've occupied, the places they've occupied since December, that there's no indication that they're preparing to leave that anytime soon, even though at the time this was called a temporary occupation or a temporary deployment. It does not seem to be all that temporary. And Benjamin Netanyahu created a bit of a stir this week when he visited the troops, as it were, who are in those areas, drew a condemnation from the Syrian government. Some international concerns, I guess, were raised. So, yeah, the greater Israel project is I guess, continuing apace is the message.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too, but it's worth it. And it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/thenation. That's BetterHelp.com/thenation.
Let's turn to North Korea and let's talk about these nuclear submarines.
Yeah, this is North Korea and South Korea. The U.S. and South Korean governments reached agreement on a proposal to manufacture nuclear-powered attack submarines for South Korea. This was part of the trade talks that the Trump administration engaged in with the South Korean government. It's part of Trump's plan to have South Korea invest in U.S. shipbuilding capacity because these things would be manufactured, at least in theory, at a shipyard in Philadelphia. So that would require the South Koreans, if they want to, you know, fit that yard to be able to build nuclear powered attack submarines, they would have to invest in that shipyard to do so. So it seems to be tied up in that as well. Shipbuilding has been a big priority for Trump since he came back into office. The South Koreans want nuclear powered submarines mostly to stay at parity with North Korea, which is also developing or says it's developing nuclear powered submarines and is probably getting help from Russia to do so. There are advantages to nuclear-powered submarines, obviously, over diesel-powered. They have greater range. They can stay at sea longer. They're faster. The degree to which that would matter in a submarine war between South Korea and North Korea is questionable, I think. But there's also the political aspect of this, that if North Korea is moving this far ahead in its weapons development program, that any South Korean government is going to want to be able to claim that it's at least remaining at parity, if not, you know, trying to leapfrog the North Koreans to kind of keep up. So that I think is the main benefit that comes out of this for the South Koreans is simply the public political aspect of it. But it is for the U.S. another case of, like Joe Biden's most impressive accomplishment, AUKUS, it's another case of the U.S. outfitting a Pacific ally with nuclear powered subs in probably a message to China though, you know, none of these countries want to talk about it in those terms because they don't want to anger Beijing. But this is, you know, inextricable from new Cold War considerations in that respect.
You know my policy, nuclear subs for everyone. Let's talk about this big church attack in Nigeria.
It's big in the symbolic sense, I think. I mean, it was, I don't know the full casualty figures, but on Wednesday or Tuesday evening, rather, was reported on Wednesday, but Tuesday evening, gunmen attacked a church in western Nigeria's Kwara state. They killed at least two people. That was the figure I saw at the time. They abducted a number of others who may be in dire conditions, including the pastor of the church. I don't have any information. I haven't seen anything out in the news about the identities of the attackers. It should be noted that the Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin group, the jihadist group that is based mainly in Mali and Burkina Faso, claimed last month to have carried out an attack in Kwara state in Nigeria. This was a somewhat surprising development because JNIM is, you know, does not typically operate that far east. But it wasn't claimed by the central kind of JNIM organization in Mali. So it's possible some, you know, sort of group of locals just decided to adopt the name or, you know, claim an affiliation that doesn't necessarily exist. We don't really know, but I think it's worth noting in light of this attack and where it was located. The reason that I think it's significant is because, of course, as we've talked about, there is this there was this push from Trump a couple of weeks ago, and you know, who knows if he's still paying attention or still, you know, if it's still on his radar, but to, you know, cut aid to Nigeria, to threaten a military intervention in Nigeria because of this idea that there's a Christian genocide happening in Nigeria. It's a fictitious idea, but it's one that has a lot of play on the right in the U.S., the religious right. And so, you know, Trump is, if he's still paying attention, this is the kind of thing he's going to look at and say, you know, this is another attack targeting Christians and could advance the process of, you know, the U.S. maybe getting involved at some level.
Let's turn to the Democratic Republic of the Congo and let's talk about the new peace framework that is being developed.
This was signed over the weekend after another round of negotiations in Qatar between the Congolese government and the M23 militant group. It replaces, I guess, a framework that they signed back in July. I don't know what really differentiates this one from that one, except for the fact that that one had collapsed and they needed a new one to replace it. And it's only been a few days, so this one hasn't collapsed yet. It outlines eight steps that need to be taken to get to a full peace deal and resolve the M23 conflict, at least for the time being. Only two of them, to my knowledge, have been worked out in any detail. There's a prisoner release, or a prisoner exchange that's supposed to take place, and they're supposed to create a ceasefire monitoring group. They've made substantial progress, I think, on the ceasefire monitoring group. The prisoner release was in the first framework and never happened. And that's part of the reason why that framework collapsed, because the very first trust building step never took place. So we'll see if it happens now under this replacement framework. I don't know. But hopefully this is a step toward resolving that conflict.
Let's do an elections update. Let's start with Chile.
The first round, Chile held its general election, and that included the first round of its presidential election. No candidate won enough of the vote to take a first round outright victory. So the two top finishers will be heading to a runoff on December 14th. Those are the Communist Party candidate Jeanette Jara and right-winger, far-right José Antonio Kast. Jara won nominally the first round. She took 26% of the vote to Kast 24%. But the expectation is that Kast will win the second round. I suspect relatively handily. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's going to be terribly close. Polling has favored Kast in a head-to-head matchup. The overall right-wing vote, if you group all of the right-wing candidates, Kast and others, together in that first round, was about 54% of the vote. So if that if he gets all of those votes, obviously he will win by comfortable, not huge, but a comfortable margin. Anyway, it all adds up to leave Cost, I think, as the favorite to win, and you know, another counter pink tide, if you want to classify things in that way, election.
Yeah, and we've actually got an episode coming up about that on Latin American policy. So keep your ears open. What do you say? Keep your eyes out on your podcast app and your ears open to listen. That's really stupid. Let's talk about the election in Ecuador.
This one was a referendum on a number of things that President Daniel Noboa, there were six items on the referendum that he wanted to see passed. Interestingly, for a president who's still pretty popular, as far as I know, just won re-election not that long ago, he lost on at least the two main points, the main elements of the referendum that he was interested in, lost on both of them. One was a proposal to rewrite the Ecuadorian constitution. That was defeated. The one that's gotten more attention was a proposal to reopen Ecuador to foreign military presence. Legally, at this point, the country is closed off to foreign military presence. The U.S. Would very much like to put a base in Ecuador, at least one, and Noboa would very much like to have the U.S. military in Ecuador to enhance his status as a tough on crime, tough on drugs, whatever, you know, he's looking for here, and to get, you know, some bennies from the Trump administration. That was defeated pretty handily, I think. I haven't seen the final count, but with most of the vote, like three quarters of the vote in, the last time I saw this, it was 60% had voted against allowing a foreign military into Ecuador. So that also seems to have gone down to defeat. Noboa promised to honor the will of the voters. So that would, you would think, mean that he's not going to try some end around to bring the U.S. military into Ecuador anyway. But I suspect that may be on the table. Something to keep an eye on.
All right, Derek, let's end with some news on the U.S.-Venezuelan relationship, war, regime change operation. Let's start with this back channel that Trump has reopened.
Yeah, the New York Times reported on Wednesday that Trump, this is sort of a double-edged thing. The headline was that Trump has signed off on CIA plans to take covert measures in Venezuela, including the kinds of measures that the CIA might take ahead of a war, ahead of more intense military action to try and get rid of Maduro or, you know, whatever goal Trump thinks he's trying to achieve in Venezuela. But underneath that, the Times also reported that he has reopened the back channel negotiations that he had previously, I don't know if they're still going to be run by Richard Grenell, the deputy chair of the Kennedy Center or whatever he's doing now. I don't know. But he was serving for a while as Trump's envoy to Venezuela and met with Nicolas Maduro, met with other Venezuelan officials, had a number of things, got a few U.S. detainees released from Venezuelan custody. Trump famously last month called Grenell in the middle of a staff meeting with Marco Rubio and the rest of the team on Venezuela and shut down the negotiating channel, like told him in the middle of the meeting, we're not talking to Maduro anymore. What seemed at that time like a commitment to military force. Now, apparently, he's reopened negotiations. At one point, it's been reported, and who knows how much credence to give this, it's been reported that Maduro offered to step down as Venezuelan president after a decent interval. He wanted 2 to 3 years, I think, to wind things down and get out. The Trump administration rejected that, but that could be negotiable. Could also be negotiable in terms of whatever Trump wants here, if it's access to Venezuelan oil or some demonstrative thing having to do with drugs, who knows? But there could be the basis for a negotiation here. But at the same time, as I said, we're also authorizing CIA action. We've got the Gerald Ford arriving in the Caribbean and its carrier group. We've also got the administration preparing to designate the Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organization, which could justify military action against Maduro, against the Venezuelan government, because Cartel de los Soles, as we talked about with Alex Zavinian and Gabriel Hetland a while back is not a real thing. It doesn't exist. It's a moniker that was created decades ago to talk about corruption and drug trading within the Venezuelan military. It is not an actual organization. Nicolas Maduro is not actually running it because it doesn't really exist. But because of that, this sort of fictitious designation as a terrorist organization basically allows it to serve as a proxy for declaring Maduro's government a terrorist organization, which, again, opens up lots of legal horizons, legal vistas for military action. So things seem to be trending in two directions simultaneously. And I think Trump still hasn't really made up his mind what he wants to do here.
Certainly what it seems like. And let's end on an update on Operation Southern Spear, which is the more aggressive thing happening here.
Yeah, Pete Hegseth, the first update is that it exists. Pete Hegseth announced it last Thursday evening that we're Operation Southern Spear is a go. It was unclear initially what he was talking about. I think there was some fear that this was the prelude to war with Venezuela or to airstrikes on Venezuela, Colombia, Mexico, who knows. It seems like this was just a branding operation for the war on drug boats, because that's all that's continued under the rubric of Operation Southern Spear. I do want to note, and Hegseth tweeted out, I don't know why, but he tweeted the names of all the military operations that Trump has approved so far in his second term: Operation Rough Rider, Operation Midnight Hammer, and Operation Southern Spear. And I just want to say, if there's anybody at the Pentagon who's working through some issues, you need some help, you need to reach out to somebody, there are people who can help you. There are numbers you can call. Just throwing that out there if anybody is in crisis at the Pentagon. But yes, it sounds like this is basically just the operation name now for for blowing up these boats that are ostensibly, carrying fentanyl to the United States from Venezuela, even though no fentanyl comes to the United States from Venezuela. But that's, the interpretation that we get from the Trump administration. We've now murdered basically somewhere around 80 people in this campaign, which began at the beginning of September, at least 21 boats. I may have missed one or two in there, but that's my count, at least 21 boats and over 80 murders, summary executions, extrajudicial assassinations, whatever you want to call them, executions. That's what Southern Spear amounts to. It is based, again, on the fiction that we're preventing somehow fentanyl from being loaded onto short-range speedboats and sailed all the way from Venezuela, a country that doesn't produce any fentanyl, to the United States. It's a marker, milestone, really, I think, in the war on drugs and the war on terror, because they're all one thing at this point.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please subscribe to the show. It takes a lot of work, and we appreciate your moolah. Keep your eye out for that History of China series, Chinese Prestige. If you'd like, join the Discord. It is, I really actually like chatting there. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.